So I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but this summer there was something tragic that happened in the Brainerd Lakes area. It was the closing of an establishment that would be greatly missed, and that establishment is Burger King. Now, for some of you, that's funny, and I understand that, because in my adult life, Burger King has not played a role at all. But growing up, on the way back from basketball games, we would actually stop at Burger King, usually is where we would stop, and I would always get a chicken whopper plain, which is basically like a big piece of grilled chicken on a bun, and a medium chocolate shake every time. So I have fond memories of Burger King. Also, growing up, when we were younger, on our birthdays, we would go to Burger King before school to have breakfast. And I would always get breakfast buddies, and it was a great, heartwarming thing. You guys just don't understand. It's okay. Back in 1974, Burger King had a commercial that was a family walking into Burger King, and the slogan of their Burger King's thing was, "Have it your way." It was one of the first places where you could actually go and order. That was kind of their mantra. You can go and you can order how you want it. And so the guy walks up to the cash register, place to order, and he says, "Now, would it be too much time to order my Whopper without pickles and lettuce?" And then the lady responds in song of, "Hold the pickles, hold the lettuce, special orders, don't upset us. You can have it your way at Burger King." Basically, and the family's all happy, and I'm so glad I can have it my way. And it's a beautiful picture of Burger King and family life in the 70s. So remember that David, where we pick up tonight, David was at the king of the Philistines, and he thought he could maybe get some help from them, but then realized that they kind of remembered who he was, and so David pretends he's crazy in order to get out of the situation, remember? Okay, so David is a full-on fugitive on the run. So starting in verse 1 of chapter 22, David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became commander over them. And there were with him about 400 men. Have you ever been desperate for change? You're in a situation, life's going a certain way, and you're just desperate for something to happen, desperate for change to come. That's what these group of people, it was 400 people, 400 men who were desperate for change. I kind of think of the Island of Misfit Toys, however, these guys aren't necessarily misfits, but that's what bonds them together. People who were hurting, people who were in need of new, people who were disheartened, desperate for change. And this becomes David's army, and he becomes commander of them. And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and my mother stay with you till I know what God will do for me." And he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Then the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not remain in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. Did you catch that? Did you catch it? So David is providing a safe place for his mom and dad, which is cool, right? Because he thinks, you know, obviously Saul might come after them. So he provides a safe place. But did you see what he says? He says, "Till I know what God will do for me." David doesn't know what's going to happen next. David doesn't know what's around the next corner. He knows someday he's going to be king, but he doesn't know the who, the what, the how. He knows God is going to make it happen and that God will provide and God will protect. So, but he's literally living a day at a time, not sure what's around the corner, not sure where to go next. God hasn't given him this day-to-day itinerary or plan. Even God hasn't even told him the year it will happen. God has just asked him to trust and obey. Man, is that hard. Sometimes I think that knowing God's will means knowing exactly what the next thing is. But it's not. It means trusting and obeying and that God will show up. We are on a need-to-know basis with God because that takes faith. that when we need to know, it will be there. How many of you are like, I like to know what's going to happen, right? We want to know. We want to know what's coming next. We want to know when it's going to happen, what I can expect, what's going to be there, how it's going to be. But when we need to know, it will be there. God will show us. David is a fugitive on the run for his life, and he doesn't know what's around the next corner. Verse 6. Now Saul heard that David was discovered, and the men who were with him. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, people of Benjamin. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day." Saul's basically having this pity party. None of you feel bad for me. No one told me what was going to happen. He's basically whining, and he's a little upset, right? Why are you siding with this David guy? Are you all just deceiving me? Do you think David can give you more than I can? It's interesting, because when Saul says, "Will the son of Jesse," which is who, right? David, yeah. "Will the son of Jesse give you everything, every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Their response would be, "No, and neither will you." It's ironic, because the king doesn't do those things. Saul hasn't done those things. And in saying it, Saul's really showing actually how little he knows about being king. And it's also, you know, amidst throwing this pity party for himself, he's also discrediting himself as king even more. Verse 9, "Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul." Notice that Doeg wasn't even a servant of Saul. He stood next to them. He was like a wannabe, right? "He stood by the servants of Saul, saying, 'I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. I saw him do it. It was Jimmy. I saw him do it,'" right? There's this like tattletale feeling behind what he says. He's a suck up. He's coming forward to try and get the brownie points. Remember last week that I told you that David went to the priest of Nob, and we looked at that a little bit in chapter 21, and he asked him for bread and he asked him for a weapon, and the priest gave him those things. The weapon being the sword of who? Right, Goliath. And he gave him those things under the impression that David was on this mission from the king. David had kind of let on that that's what was happening. So in Ahimelech's eyes, and what he did wasn't wrong, because David was the one who told him these things, right? Well, Doeg is like, "I saw Ahimelech give him the sword and give him provisions." So Saul sends for Ahimelech to come and to hear his story. "Okay, Ahimelech, you did this. Tell me what happened." And Saul asks him, "Why have you conspired against me? Why did you do this thing? You of all people, a priest." And the way that Ahimelech replies is in this pretty well-crafted way. That doesn't, when we read it, if I were to read it to you, you'd be like, huh? But basically, he's trying to, one, paint David in a good light. In that David, you understand that through all of this, David has been innocent. Other than the fact that he just lied to me about being on a mission from the king, but basically, Ahimelech knows he's been trying to kill David. He's like, David is innocent. Also, Ahimelech didn't realize that he was going against the king. So he wants to show, like, hey, also, I'm innocent. And also, he doesn't want to come at him like, Saul, you're wrong, because he's the king. And so he wants to respect him. And the way that he does that, he actually crafts his response very well. But this is what Saul says. Verse 17, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David. And they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me. But the servants of the king would not put their hand to strike the priests of the Lord." They're the priests of the Lord, right? We're not going to kill them. Why would we kill all of them? They were the ones that would intercede for the sacrifices that needed to be made in order for the people to be made clean before God. They wore these robes robes called ephods, and it brought them to a place where they could inquire of God. Remember, you and I live in a time after Jesus has been on earth, after he died, after he rose again. And you and I live in a time where, and when we have given our lives to Jesus and we've accepted the sacrifice of what he did on the cross, we have the Holy Spirit in us. We are given the gift of the Holy Spirit. And we can access God and talk to God anytime, anywhere that we want, which is a really, really cool thing that we get to be a part of, that even some of the like people in the Old Testament who we would say are like high, well-known names like David or Moses or all those things, they didn't have that. And so they had different ways of accessing God, and God spoke to them in different ways, but not at all times in all places. And one of those ways of having access to God was through the priests. And Saul was like, kill them all. But the servants wouldn't do it. However, Doeg was still there, trying to earn his brownie points. Verse 18. Then the king said to Doeg, you turn and strike the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned, and he struck down the priests, and he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep he put to the sword. You guys, this goes from the execution of one priest who did wrong in the eyes of the king, even though he was never proven guilty, to help a man, David, who was also never proven guilty. So it goes from executing one man where there was no proof of anything done wrong to complete and mindless bloodshed. It's this huge picture of vengeance. It's a horrible, horrible scene that contrasts and shows even more just how much Saul was outside of what God wanted. But with it comes this plot twist in verse 20. But, and I love the word but in the Bible, it's my favorite word, but one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped, and he fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day, when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me, you shall be in safe keeping. Two things happen here. So this priest escapes and he runs to David. And number one, David says, it was my fault. It's my fault that all those people died because I saw that Doeg was there and I knew he would tell. When in reality, David was not responsible for the death of all those people, but he takes it on himself. The even bigger thing that happens is that David now has a priest with him. So Saul, through his vengeance and his actions, loses all priestly support. And once again, what Saul planned for bad, God used for good by allowing a priest to escape and escape to David. And now David has priestly support and has access to God 24/7, and they are both on the run. At the beginning of chapter 23, there's this break from running because David hears that the Philistines were fighting and plundering, like stealing things from the city of Keilah. And we see David in verse 2, it says that he inquires of the Lord. Inquire meaning he asks. He talks to God and he asks. Notice how many times we're going to see that over the next few chapters. He asks God, should I go attack the Philistines? Should I go fight them? Anyone around, we're looking at David like, no, you're in hiding. Why would you do that? Why would you even think about putting yourself out there? People are going to see you. Saul's going to hear about it. He's going to know where you are. Seems crazy, right? But he's like, I'm going to ask God. And God tells him to go and to save the city. But his men, remember he had his army, his men were scared. And they were like, we're in hiding. We're putting ourselves at more risk if we go there and fight. This is not going to go unnoticed. Saul's going to find out. So in verse 4, it says, then David inquired of the Lord again. And I think it was really for the sake of the army, for him to say, like, okay, do you want me to go ask God again to make sure? So he inquires of the Lord again, and the Lord answers him in the same way, of course. Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand. And they went, and they fought, and they saved the entire city. Verse 6, when Abiathar, remember that's the priest, the son of Ahimelech, had fled to David to Keilah, we'll go with Keilah. He had come down with an ephod in his hand. Now it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah, and Saul said, God has given him into my hand, for he has shut himself by entering a town that has gates and bars. You guys, look at this. Saul believes that it is God who has delivered David into his hands. It's amazing that when we aren't seeking God, when we aren't asking him, how we can look at situations and we can give God credit for it when in reality it's not God. We can look at it because sometimes it's because we want, or surely let this is what God has, when in reality God's like, no, that's not what I have. We can be so deceived when we don't look to God for his perspective on the situation. And Saul is so deceived and deceiving himself. Verse 8. It says, and Saul summoned all the people to war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. David knew that Saul was plotting harm against him, and he said to Abiathar the priest, bring the ephod here. Then David said, O Lord, the God of Israel, your servant has surely heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. Will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord, the God of Israel, please tell your servant. And the Lord said, he will come down. Then David said, will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul? And the Lord said, they will surrender you. So what does David do? He talks to God about it. He sees the situation and he's like, okay, God, this is what I see happening. This is what I see going on. But what are you doing here? Is what I'm seeing accurate? Is there a difference? Is there a different take on the situation that I should know about? What's going to happen? He asks him. Do you see the difference between David and Saul in this moment? Do you see the contrast? David wants to see the situation through the reality of what God has. And Saul sees the situation through his own reality and says, it must be God. You see the difference? And since God told him that they were about to be delivered into the hands of Saul by the same city that they had just saved, by the way, hey, these people who we just saved their lives, are they about to hand us over to Saul? Instead of thinking, oh, these people would never hand us over, we just saved their lives. He says, wait, are they going to hand us over? And God's like, yep. So they fled. And it says Saul sought him every day. And we don't have the time to get into it, but Jonathan meets up with David again and makes another covenant, a renewal of his covenant and promise and friendship. And he says, don't fear. God is with you and God will save you. It's almost this like moment of encouragement for David, because right now, a lot of the time, like his men are kind of questioning things, or he kind of is on his own, it seems, other than that he has God, which is enough. But God gives him this blessing of a moment with Jonathan. And then we have this scene that in a movie seriously would be epic. The music would get intense. It would get quiet with intense music. You start sweating a little bit. You're holding your breath because Saul gets word of exactly where David is, and he's hiding among the strongholds along a hill. And again, Saul believes, and he even says, like, this is the hand of God. This is the time when God's going to give him over. And Saul gets clarification where exactly David is. And David knows he's coming, but he's almost in this like trapped place. And it says that Saul is on one side of the mountain, and David and his men are on the other side. And in the movie, you as a viewer would go back and forth between them. And you know they're almost walking towards each other. They're getting closer and closer together. And as Saul's seeking David's life, the music gets more and more intense. And it's almost, you know, like if they were in a crime movie, right? And there's like a corner of a building. It's like they're like about to meet at the corner. And you're holding your breath and you're like, no, 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 no. And then the phone rings. Not your phone. Saul's phone, right? A messenger, it says in verse 27, a messenger came to Saul saying, hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid against the land. Didn't quite have a phone, right? But it was that close. And the messenger comes and says, you got to go. And so Saul leaves. And the viewers breathe. And they're like, oh my goodness, that was close. In the mountain they were seeking David on was named the Rock of Escape. How cool is that? And David, and it says that David went from there and he lived in this place called En-Gedi. And verse 1 of chapter 24 says, when Saul returned from following the Philistines, so remember he had gone off to the Philistines, he was told, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of wild goat's rocks. And he came to the sheepfolds by the way where there was a cave. And Saul went in to relieve himself. We're all on the same page of what that means? Saul went in to relieve himself. Now, David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. Now, this cave would have been big, okay? And because usually you would bring, like, your whole herd of sheep in there. So that's why it was big enough to hold, like, their whole army. So David and his men are hiding in the cave. And can you picture the scene, you guys? It's like the next part of the scene in the movie. David and his men are in the cave. And now Saul is walking into the cave, has no idea they're there. He's relieving himself. His 3,000 men are no longer around him because he's left them outside. And David is watching this happen. And Saul's going to the bathroom. And David's men say exactly what you and I would think. Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you. This is it. This is the moment you can kill him. He's right there so easily. Surely God has put him here for you to have victory over him. Doesn't it make sense? That's what this moment is here for. But David does something super intriguing, super unexpected. It says, then David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And afterward, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. So David doesn't kill him. He cuts off a piece of his robe. And even that, even just that action, David's heart feels heavy. And the reason why is because by doing so, cutting off a piece of his robe is a symbolic act of claiming the kingdom. Of saying, I could have killed you, I didn't, but your kingdom is mine. That's kind of what he's saying. But David knew that that wasn't true yet. He knew that the timing wasn't there. David knew that it would be in God's timing. David knew that it was not in his hands to kill Saul or to take the kingdom. It would be that God would give it to him. That this was God's battle. That God would deal with him in his way rather than in David's way or the rest of the army that was in the cave. Which I can't imagine that David, the rest of the army didn't go kill him. Right? Just attack. But he persuades them. It says even David persuaded his men with these words. And David goes out after Saul and has a conversation with him. And he says to him, in all humility and in total realness of heart, afterward, David also rose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, my Lord the king. And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, why do you listen to the words of men who say, behold, David seeks your harm? Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you into my hand in the cave. And some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog, after a flea. May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you, and see to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand. And Saul responds, and he actually weeps. And for the first time, Saul's eyes become clear and open. And he sees the reality, and he acknowledges that David will be king, that it is who God has. And he kind of surrenders to that reality now, finally. And Saul asks, please, when you become king, don't cut off my offspring, which we know that David has already promised that to Jonathan. But he swears to Saul. He says, I won't. And Saul leaves. It's interesting, in the commercial that I talked about at the beginning of tonight, that it wasn't just about have it your way. The man asks the lady at the cashier, would it take any extra time to have it without pickles and lettuce? Not only does he want it his way, but he wants it quick. He wants it in his time. Because if it would take extra time, he probably wouldn't do it. And if there's anything we can see over and over through the story, is that God's way and God's time are what is going to be the best. And everything in Saul fights that. I can imagine that David would have fought that too. But he continued to inquire of the Lord, to ask him. You guys, everything in us fights against God's way and God's timing, because we want it to happen in our way and we want it to happen now. We fight against God's way and God's timing unless we are seeking him. Unless we are inquiring and asking of him. You guys, God's way and God's timing are always the best. Even when we get frustrated by it, it is always the best. And so may we be a people who seek his way, his timing, and inquire of the Lord every day of our lives.